Major Kong. I know you think this is crazy, but I just got a message from base over the CRN 114. And he called his wing attack plan R. R for Romeo.
Movie? Did you say wing attack plan R?
Yes, sir, I have.
Goldie, how many times have I told you guys that I don't want no horsing around on the airplane?
I'm not horsing around, sir. That's how it decodes.
Well, I've been to One World Fair, a picnic, and a rodeo, and that's the stupidest thing I ever heard come over a set of earphones. You sure you got today's code?
Yes, sir, it is.
Oh, there's just got to be something wrong. Wait a second, I'm coming back. Maybe you better get a confirmation from base.
Yes, sir.
Major Kong, is it possible this is some kind of loyalty test, you know, give the go code and then recall and see who would actually go?
Ain't nobody ever got the go code yet. An old Ripper wouldn't be giving us plan R unless them Ruskies had already clobbered Washington and a lot of other towns with a sneak attack.
Yes, sir.
Major Kong, message from base confirmed.
Well, boys, I reckon this is it. Nuclear combat toe-to-toe with the Ruskies. Look, boys, ain't much of a hand at making speeches. I got a pretty fair idea that something doggone important is going on back there. I got a fair idea of the kind of personal emotions that some of you fellas may be thinking. Heck, I reckon you wouldn't even be human beings if you didn't have some pretty strong personal feelings about nuclear combat. I want you to remember one thing, that folks back home is counting on you, and by golly, we ain't about to let them down. I'll tell you something else. This thing turns out to be half as important as I figured it just might be. I'd say that you're all in line for some important promotions and personal citations when this thing's over with. That goes for every last one of you, regardless of your race, color, or your creed. Now let's get this thing on the hump. We got some flying to do.
I'm itching to get into Russell's paradox.
Then do it.
Yeah.
It's so this is a result about 1901 came out. So just to give a back onto this, so in the 1900s, later 1900s, there's a mathematician, logician named Gottlieb Frege, who was trying to formalize mathematics because there were a number of quite what he saw to be kind of sloppy mathematical reasoning. He wanted to set it on a more firm mathematical foundation. So just to give like an example of this, if we generally, there's the idea that if you have an equation, you have something equal to another thing, you can perform any arithmetic operation on each side and still maintain the equality, right? That sounds perfectly reasonable. But say if you take 0 times 1, you write it down, equals 0 times 2. So on each side, it's equal to 0. So you just wrote down 0 equals 0, which is a true statement. But then if you divide by 0, then you end up with 1 equals 2, which is a false statement. So that would be an example. So we have to review, this idea of is it true if you, as long as you perform the same mathematical operation on each side of an equation, do you maintain equality? Well, no, here's an example where that's not the case. So the solution to this is to come up with a rule of, okay, you can divide by anything, but you just cannot divide by zero. So this is just a demonstration of one step towards formalism, where we have, we need to have rules for our mathematical reasoning. And so this is what Gottlieb Frege tried to do to a much greater extent. And so, you know, his life's work was publishing these three volumes of mathematical rules, in a sense. And we still use some of his notation today, still. But when the third volume was in publication, Bertrand Russell asked him a question. He said, you know, does this, if you take the set of all sets that do not contain themselves, does that set contain itself? And you end up with a paradox, because I'm going to breeze through this and then...
No, could you repeat just that last part?
Yeah, okay, so this is actually what Russell's paradox is. So if you define the set of all sets that do not contain themselves, historically it's called R, the set R, the set of all sets that do not contain themselves. So if you ask, does this set R contain itself? You will reach a paradox, because by definition, if it contains itself, then it cannot contain itself by definition. But then if it doesn't contain itself, then also by definition, it should then contain itself, or it should be contained in R, which would then mean it contains itself. So this is what Russell's paradox is.
So you have R is the set that contains everything except itself, and then once you put that in a set...
No, sorry. Okay, I'll take it a little bit more slowly. So,
thank you.
Say you define the set C. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is the set of all coffee cups. Okay, so if you have a coffee cup, like I have right here at my desk, so that this coffee cup would be contained within the set C. Okay, this lamp here would not be contained within the set. Okay, so we ask the question, does the set C itself contain itself? Okay, and so then the answer to that would be no, because the set itself is an abstraction. It's not a coffee cup. So C does not contain C. Right. So C would be an example of a set that does not contain itself. Okay. So now you take the set, define a set called N of all non-coffee cups. So everything which is not a coffee cup, you include in N. So this lamp now would be contained in N. I would be contained in N. We're contained in N. Coffee cup, any given coffee cup would not be contained in N. So then we can ask the question, does N contain N? Right. So N itself is an abstraction. It's a set, and it's not a coffee cup. So therefore, by definition, it contains itself. Right. So now we have N contains N.
Right. Calling you so far. Yeah. Very, very nicely explained. Got you.
Okay. Thanks. So now we have two sets here. So we have an example of a set that does not contain itself, which is C, and an example of a set which does contain itself, called N. Okay. So here we have an example. So some sets contain themselves, some sets do not. Okay. So now let's define the set R, which is a set of all sets that do not contain themselves. Okay, so for example, C would be contained in R, because C does not contain itself. However, N is not included in R, because N does include itself. So C is in R, but N is not in R. So,
gotcha. Right?
We got you.
Okay, so now you ask the question, does R contain R? And I'll be silent until you want me to speak.
Red rum. I don't know. Oh, God.
So if it's all sets that do not contain itself, it can't contain itself, because otherwise it wouldn't be included. But if it doesn't include itself, then it would be meet the criteria.
Exactly, yeah, and then it would be included in R, right?
Yeah, I got you. So, yeah, it's a paradox.
Right, so ask the question, does R contain itself? Okay, so if R contains itself, then by definition, it doesn't contain itself.
Yeah, I get that.
Okay. So then we. So then the other. So then maybe it actually. So then you could say, okay. So maybe R doesn't contain itself. But then if it doesn't contain itself in the same way that C does not contain itself, then we need to include it in R. So we basically have the conditional going both ways. R includes itself if and only if R does not include itself, which is a contradiction. And so in a similar kind of way, so this paradox was constructible within Gottlieb Frege's system. And he was never able to come up with a satisfactory patch to it. See, so like when we came up with a paradox like 0 or 1 equals 2 when we divided by 0, the patch was to define this rule in which we should never divide, we cannot divide by 0. Okay, but such a patch there is no simple patch to patch up Russell's paradox. It required a whole new foundation, looking into the foundation. And at the time, one might say, I think historically, it's even referred to kind of a crisis within the foundation of mathematics. And so this moved the direction of mathematics into this direction called formalism. And so the accepted solution now for working mathematicians, so to speak, is a formal system referred to as Zermelo-Frankel set theory, just named after the two guys that helped or that contributed to this axiomatic system. And one interesting result of this is that there is no such thing as the set of all sets, because in order to prevent Russell's paradox from being constructed, it had to limit the set operations that one can do, in the same way that our arithmetic operations were limited in order to keep the first paradox from arising. We had to limit it by not allowing division by zero. There's similar limitations.
That's right? Got so, implications. Uh-huh. It's just got,
say again?
That's got implications.
I'm yep, seeing yep, where that applies. Right. Yeah, you're sensing where I'm going with this. So
yeah.
So one result of this is that, yeah, there's no set of all sets, but it's also referred to as the universal set. So in order to maintain consistency within our mathematics, we, in a very real kind of loosely speaking sense, but still, I think, relatively accurate, can say that mathematicians, they deny the existence of the universe.
Because they have to.
In order to maintain consistency.
Wow. What about Jack Parsons reciting the hymn to Pan at every launch? You get it? Because Pan is everything. Pan is the system of all systems, right? So it's saying you can't add to the all, you can't take away from the all. And that's and then meanwhile, you're shooting a rocket out into space. Sorry, that's tripping.
Right, so it's like if you tried to create a life-size model of the universe within this universe, then it's no longer a it's no longer an accurate model.
Or we get plagued with paradoxes.
Right.
Yeah.
So the can you maybe try and dumb down the solution to that? Like what you said, these two guys came up with their rule is you're saying is essentially boils down to deny there is no universe, there is no universal set.
Well, yeah, I mean that's not said specifically within the system. It's basically just a finite, like a small number, like a handful of axioms. Like for instance, one of the axioms is like the null set or the empty set is a set, and then you can construct, say, the set containing the empty set, and this is actually how you can construct basic arithmetic. In this way, you can equate like the null set with zero and the set containing the null set with one, and then the set containing those two things of the null set and the set containing the null set with two, etc. And so it's a very, very stepwise, baby step kind of way of constructing set theory. But we can't just come out, there's nothing that allows us to just come out and say we have the set of all sets. So it's very restrictive in this way. but it's good enough to, say, give us all of calculus and whatever, you know, engineering mathematics that we need. But it's it limits our conceptions of infinity, and you know, we can't speak of the set of all sets. It's an ill-defined
concept. That's like Howell. Because like Howell is like a singularity, supposedly. He's a singular I, right? But he's like a substitute singular I, because like that's the difference between like the actual Ein Sof, if you go beyond the infinite, which is to admit a singularity, in a sense. Like, in order to go beyond the infinite in terms of dimensionality, you have like the cube of space, and then you have to have the transcendent point where all points converge and thus transcend the dimension. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, Hal is like, he's like a representation of the thing, but he's not the thing. And so all he's going to do is destroy. Because you can't imitate that. That won't accept an imitation. Like, but you...
Okay.
I don't know. I see, because we're doing the same thing. We're like relating to it as if... Because, I mean, you hear it all the time. Like, all is one, right? Like, people say that, then don't skip a beat. Like, but the implications of that, like, what does that actually mean? Because it cancels out pretty much our whole, everything we've gone to the trouble to build up.
Right. I mean, you know, this is funny, because I had issue with this, you know, it's like, again, it's totally a paradox, which I'm comfortable with paradoxes to a certain extent conceptually. I think it's a lot of the answers we come to have a paradoxical nature. But Jay Cutts put something on Facebook yesterday saying, like, you know, I'm going to butcher this. It was basically to honor a part is to honor the whole. And to criticize a part is to criticize the whole. This idea is that you have to love the all, the totality. And I was thinking, I saw that in my first thought. It's a kind of crude thought, but I thought, but you still wipe your ass, right? Like, there's still things that you view as, you still expel waste from your body. You still say, you could say, that's part of me, and honor it in the... in a conceptual level, but in a practical level, you don't want to carry that around with you all day.
I can't help but bring up memories from my time in 2009 when I lived in Alaska, and I actually took up composting, and we actually collected what we called humanure, and you know, we took kitchen scraps and human waste, and mixed it with sawdust, and we had these bins, and within 6 months, we mix it up very thoroughly, and actually it was a very interesting science experiment. I mean, the temperatures would get up to like over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe much, much more than that, and then after a 6 month period, it was just absolutely wonderful soil, and the vegetables that I've eaten from as a result of that were absolutely the best. No place has ever, no restaurant nowhere has had anything better. And I think it's, well, on the one, two things, I guess. One is just it just shows how nutrient absent our farms have become, but you know, how food really should taste. I mean, this is, I'm sure, like, you know, a couple hundred years ago, this is how, this was normal. So it's all part of this recycling. I mean, it is even, you know, waste is a precious thing in that sense.
Yeah, the Klipo themselves, considering I was speaking to this earlier, are taken as feces, that as actually the tree exists, would not exist without it. And that was actually my inspiration for calling my Hollywood Holy Mountain sink holy shit, on top of the fact that turning shit into gold is their alchemical, that's like the essence of the film, you know. But I liked that I that's very reconciling to an extent to relate to the that side of it as something that's needed to be there as well. But I don't think that negates Alan's point, which is that there's a distinction, but there's no separation. And the fact that there's no separation doesn't downgrade the distinction. Like, it doesn't negate it, you know? I mean, that distinction is still relevant. And it's, I mean, it's a matter of what you take as primary, I guess, in how you're relating to it. I think Jake is probably taking it, you know, he's just taking the ultimate position as the primary perspective. And I doubt that he's, you know, negating that distinction. I think the distinction gets emphasized far too much a lot of the time. So he's doing something good there.
I agree. Yeah, it's yeah. You totally get me. It's not a matter of making a distinction for distinction's sake or to criticize or anything. And Matt, your point is also valid. Is that, you know, there are ways to keep that, how should we say, what we view as toxic is not necessarily so. So I think all those points are extremely valid. Again, it was meant less as an attack on Jake and more as a sort of, as a lot of the things we're discussing here could almost be like these kind of Zen things to meditate upon. It's like, well, how, you know, how does this apply in a practical level? Do we make that distinction? All those sorts of questions that we could pull out of that. It was more of a question for myself than trying to negate his comment or anything like that.
I think the point is that ego is an illusion, and that paradox that you were speaking to earlier, Matt, was kind of like, I mean, that's the basis. The ego starts with an assumption in order to continue to build. Like, you need to assume these things in order to, you know, keep going. But you can have, it's like if you have an argument and there's something in the fundamental initial steps of the argument that is skipped over, it doesn't actually fit, you can keep going and it can go on indefinitely, and if at its basis there's a hole, then right, everything that you've built becomes meaningless. And so I relate to 2001 through that lens whenever I watch it. But that's, on a certain level, seems to be what's being communicated. And I don't think I'm alone in that interpretation either.
No, and I even, you know, I had earlier this year, I had the experience where I talked about in the episode with Mark Leclerc, where I took a way too much hash and went to see 2001 A Space Odyssey in the theaters, and I talked about how I was able to view the movie through Mark's eyes, which was a pretty heavy and intense experience. But what I didn't really talk about is what followed after that when I came home, and I had this really Gnostic experience of the world being a matrix, it being an illusion, all this sort of stuff. But it was also a very traditional spiritual connection of realizing, you know, you are the one, you are an aspect of God. And there's the idea of recognizing that you're one, but at the moment of realizing I was one, that I am, you know, there is nothing separate from me, it was the most heartbreaking loneliness like I've never felt ever in my life. And this is, if you look at the Gnostic myths, this is why the all, the one, Brahma separates into these separate pieces in which to experience different aspects of itself. So on one level, it was realizing that the experiences that you could create for yourself to experience your wonder through were, in a sense, illusory, it was an illusionary matrix that was simply a model of a model of a model of a model, and at the same time, to not do it was in itself unbearably lonely. It wasn't, you know, oh, I'm so happy to be reunited with the All, it was, if this is the All, there's no one here to share it with me. So you have to become, it's sort of like the paradox is being torn between being a lonely god or a schizophrenic god. And, you know, again, this is not to say this is the answer, I'm just saying this was my experience, which was really brought upon by this movie. And to me, this is a sort of a paradox, that, again, that I've grown more comfortable with. In the moment of being intoxicated and being overwhelmed with the experience, it was pretty rough. At this point, I'm kind of back to where I normally lay, which is, of course, we're all one, and we chose to be individuals, and we need to celebrate that individual nature while still honoring the fact that we're all essentially one. It's like I recognize the God within you, but in a more of a namaste motherfucker sort of sense of, I recognize the God within you and the God within me and so on, and I also realize that we made this choice and that there's a value in individuation. It's like, you know, if this is the grand experiment of God to see how it can explore its multiform nature, then to return to source is almost aborting the mission. It's almost, in some ways, it's almost, I hesitate to say heretical, you know, but if this was the intention of God, was to explore, to turn back to source, is almost a creature comfort. It's almost a cowardly retreat. I don't mean that as harsh as it sounds, but does that make sense?
Yeah, I would liken it to perhaps, or it's actually not, the Law of One speaks about this this cycle. I mean, it's the great heartbeat of creation, that of, you know, of unity and then differentiation, but then back to unity, and it's a natural cycle.
Absolutely, I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
So I want to mention something really quick here about your tarot, according to the Law of One, because this is a classic way to present the tarot. I forget how to pronounce it, but tarot tableau. It's the.
Oh really? I didn't know that.
Okay. To situate these cards goes. I mean, that's supposedly like how they were originally related to. So I've heard. Oh. After our we do a sync cabin event where a bunch of us hang out in a cabin for a weekend or whatever, you know, and discuss synchronicity. And our friend Doug Bowles, who does 42 minutes, he laid out the hero's journey on the floor. And I guess I had seen it before, but I hadn't really stopped and like thought about it before, where it's, you just have two rows formed in like kind of a vesica, where you form a vesica Pisces with the major arcana. And when I got home after that, I decided to lay out Aleister Crowley's deck in that way, and I wrote a thing out on it because it completely blew my mind of some of the things that show up in there. And one of the, so first of all, I've never heard this referred to as tarot according to the Law of One, but it makes perfect sense because you're relating the Fool to the other, as they're all kind of harmonized or integrated in one archetype. Is that the idea of, on a certain level, beyond what you were saying?
Harmonized specifically into the Fool archetype, you mean?
Yeah.
Is that... I don't know if that was the intent of the Law of One.
Because I actually saw it as what you were talking about before, is how you can't divide by zero because zero is the set of all sets.
Right, and
the Fool. Right, yeah. You can't remove the Fool from it because the Fool is the thing that contains all 21 other archetypes.
Right, and if you look at where it shows up on the European system on the pathways, it's Keter leading to Chochmah, which is the zero point. And so everything is one in Keter, and so that would make a lot of sense. Okay. But I was going to just point out that, you know, when you do your equivalent of the tarot tableau, otherwise you're still forming like an eye, literally, and how appropriate that is for how many freaking eyes, singular eyes, show up in like all of Kubrick's films.
Okay, right. Including, like, the slit screen when he's going through the Stargate, it shows up twice, right?
Yeah, it shows up everywhere. I mean, HAL itself is just this singular eye, and you have the, it's been pointed out many times that the monolith during the Dawn of Man, you could take as a capless pyramid with the eye on top is the eclipse.
I see. I thought you were actually talking about the letter eye, because you have the... lowercase letter I, you have the one and then the dot on top, which...
Oh, yeah, I've seen that pointed out in the Stargate sequence. I know what you're referring to.
Which, what is I but the ego?
Right, who am I?
Who am I, yeah.
I felt like that was significant enough to point out, is that you have this law of one with the tableau, and meanwhile, if it's represented as the conscious subconscious as the hero's journey to form the Vesica, it's all one as well. And that's supposed, according to Crowley, it's the eye of Shiva. So Shiva opens his eye and it's the destruction of the world, which will get recreated in a different form. And that's like the ultimate alchemy, right? But there's one thing worth pointing out. There's many things worth pointing out, but one here I'll mention is that when you go along the pathway, the upper pathway of what's supposed to be the conscious realm, and you go to the bottom pathway, when you go around the loop, the first card that appears on the bottom row is the Hanged Man, which is the reversal, which is like one of the many examples that, for me, is like an indicator that, like, yes, this is on the right track, this is what's being communicated, that you have this circle, and here's the point of flipping it. So it's literally a mirror. You're looking at the upper, and then you're looking at the lower as its own reflection, which is relevant. Even just the idea that the unconscious is the mirror of the conscious, in terms of Jung's idea of the shadow, and how Kubrick was literally obsessed with that idea and wanted to communicate it through his films, is, you know, it seems pretty apparent.
Do you think there's any... You know, when you mentioned this idea of the idea of the set of all sets and all this stuff, were you thinking in terms of that, those cards, or?
Okay, yeah, thanks for asking. So there is alchemy involved here in Russell's paradox, because we have these two concepts which are bringing together that of set and element, and that can be the idea of set, of wholeness. This could be identified with the yin kind of principle, or the female aspect within the tarot. That's one, at least in when the law of one discussion of the tarot, that different archetypes, how does he put it, that are attract various male or female polarities. So in that sense, yes, you have the yin and yang, and an element is more of the yang. It's kind of, you could take something and deconstruct it. It's more the reductionism versus holism. So element would be kind of the part, right? And so when you combine these two things together, set and element, in this particular way to construct Russell's paradox, there is this alchemy that happens, and you get this very significant kind of result. And even there, you end up having to make a choice. And that also corresponds to the tarot of the choice. The fool is the choice, according to the Law of One. In that, like, you know, how do you deal with this paradox? Like, I guess, so the choice that, say, the Western approach is to abolish paradox and go forward as far as one can with the formalistic approach, which is the mechanical, which you know, ties in with, say, you know, with HAL. The HAL kind of, HAL is very much like a formal system, like an axiomatic system where he abides by certain rules. And, you know, it's often the surface level interpretation, which many people say, is that, you know, HAL malfunctioned. And, you know, I would say no, he was acting perfectly. His only mistake was that he underestimated the resourcefulness of David to get back into the ship. But he is Hal is operating on you know, the true mission, at least the mission that he was given, of getting the film crew in hibernation. And I guess we could maybe get more into that.
That's the best part. We haven't even touched on it.
Yeah. Of getting them out to create another false flag film, pretty much. Another movie for the masses.
Do you mind if, before we go to that, this idea of Hal operating, you know, the Death Star is perfectly functional, or what is, you know, is it
fully functional? Operational.
Fully operational, right. You know, it's like, is Hal malfunctioning? I was rereading your article last night with my wife. I said, I want to review this before we speak to this guy tomorrow. Would you be interested in reading with me? So she's like, sure, and we're talking about it. And, you know, one of the things that came up, she had never seen the whole chess thing laid out before. And, I've seen that, other people make that point, but within your scope of what you're addressing, it becomes highly relevant again in a different way.
Right.
But anyway, so she says, oh, I never saw that before, that's really interesting. So we get into this conversation, is the chess, quote-unquote, screw-up, is it a malfunction of Hal, or is it part of his psychological test of Frank Poole? And I think the more straightforward analysis is traditionally, as traditional as this might be, you know, that it's Hal's, part of Hal's psychological profile. He's saying, oh, if you're not with it enough to figure out that I'm cheating at chess, then you are not in any way, shape, or form able to carry out this mission, right? And that's probably, and I'm just gonna, I mean, I could be generalizing it, but I think that's probably the more general interpretation. But what one of the things that comes in there is you make also a reference to the subtle references to Nazism throughout the movie. And when I've only seen it on the big screen once. When I did, I was astounded at how noticeable, once you can actually see all the details in crisp detail, how prevalent the IBM logo is.
Oh, yeah.
Now, people have talked about, Hal is one letter removed from IBM. And, okay, that's interesting. But when you actually see IBM everywhere, you're like, oh, shit. It just adds this extra layer of, oh, okay, he's putting IBM in your face throughout. Now, of course, she said, well, what would be the point of referencing IBM with Hal? And my instinctual answer was, well, because IBM was responsible for cataloging the Jews during the Holocaust.
Yeah, right? And I think it was like one of the first major applications of IBM, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly, yeah. So we have this idea here that, was that what Kubrick was going for? I don't know, but that was the first thing that popped in my mind is, here you have the machine that's, you know, saying, well, we have, so that we get, oh, sorry, just to go in some further, is we get this idea of, is it evil? And it's like, if Hal is operating completely functionally, it would mean that he's saying, this is the mission. I can't allow you to jeopardize the mission, is what he says to Dave, right? There's two missions, it's too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
Mm-hmm.
Which means, you know, and it's like, if you were IBM during the Third Reich, would it be that here, the country and the people in your society have stated this mission? We are working towards the grandeur of the Third Reich. And these, you know, lesser people, quote unquote, are in the way of our greatness, of our mission. And we can't allow you to jeopardize the mission. It's like, would the average German citizen or IBM or anybody, would they think of themselves as evil? Of course not. They would be thinking, this is the mission, and in order to carry it out. Any means necessary, right. And it seems to me, I just sort of wanted to bring this up in reference to you saying, I would agree with you, I don't think Hal is malfunctioning at all.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing with the chess, he actually gives Frank I might say, like a 1-2 punch there, because there's actually two kind of confusing things that Hal quickly does. So first a jab and then a punch. So the jab was first, Frank makes a move, and then Hal says, "I'm sorry, Frank, I think you missed it." Mm-hmm. And then he gives him three moves, suggesting that these are inevitable. So the first move he describes in, it's some descriptive chess notation where it's always, the convention is to always describe the position of the pieces relative to the person whose turn it is, but he actually describes it in terms of Frank's position, and so it's actually there's a mistake there, which I think is deliberate. So that was the first jab, because you can, if you watch carefully, Frank puts his head up from looking at the chessboard. He looks up at Hal very briefly, kind of confused. It's like, what are you talking about? Like, that's not accurate. But then he looks back down, and then Hal says a move that he would do, and then he says a move that Frank would do, suggesting that's inevitable, and then finally the checkmate. And so it's kind of like, within that state of mind, like having already kind of confused Frank with that jab, then the real kind of kicker, you know, which is suggesting that this move on Frank's part was inevitable, it actually isn't, that he could have actually, he didn't have to do it, he could have gone on to win, but Frank, kind of in that confused state of mind, then just accepted what Hal had said and conceded.
Darren Browned it. You ever seen Darren Brown?
Okay. I'm not familiar with that.
He's like a neurolinguistic programmer that does like a magic show with NLP and then explains to people how they were manipulated. Very similar kind of scenario.
Yeah, exactly. Very sly, just kind of slips it into the unconscious kind of thing.
Yeah.
And this was just, I guess, one interpretation is that he's keeping Frank in the movie, right? So he's kind of just buying into, like, just kind of keeping him on the psychological leash, because, you know, it's kind of his test to make sure that he can be guided and kind of just fed whatever Hal wants to tell him, that even if it's not the truth, Frank will still follow it, and in Hal's mind that he passes the test. And then he tries to do a similar thing, his own psychological evaluation of Dave, and asking him, you know, all these very leading questions about, you know, rumors on the base about something being dug up on the moon. What do you think about this? And Dave himself is being very evasive in his answers, and just saying, "Well, you know, I'm not sure what you're talking about." Like, just kind of tipping his head, playing dumb, and then he, you know, David says, "Are you working on your crew psychology report?" And then Hal says, "Yes," and then somehow in so many words says yes, but then without skipping a beat. Now that test, Hal cannot get a grasp on Dave's psychology, then immediately, even in that same scene, that's when he comes up with the AE-35 malfunction. And, I would put forth the idea this is Dave's chess test. Like, in the same way that, you know...
Totally, because it doesn't skip. It's all like, this is the same... He wants you to correlate them. Totally. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's right. It's like, oh, you caught me. Wait a minute. He even said, like, wait a minute.
Next step, because he already had it in place.
Yeah.
But then, so they bring the AE-35 unit, and Dave, of course, being his methodical self, runs a complete scan, right? I mean, other people may not even maybe bother or not be as thorough and just kind of put it back and then just say, oh, it's just, the fault is with ourselves. Because, like, I'll say, you know, the ideal crew member for Hal, from Hal's perspective, would have been someone who got the AE-35 unit, maybe checked it out a little bit, and then put it back. And then if it didn't malfunction, then the fault would be with the human. And so it's the human, like, must always be at fault. So if there's any question, then it's like they're giving up their power in some sense to the computer so that the humans can be manipulated.
Right, and even though a computer has no emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
Which is bigger than the brain, you know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They've done that test with the electromagnetic field of the brain versus the heart. This is like a legit thing. I'm not, you know, it's not like a crystal hippie deal. It's like they've looked at the torus that's generated through your, you know, your field, and that the one around your chest and your heart is much larger than your mind. And so to negate emotional intelligence is to it's like, you know, like in Metropolis, where they say the intermediary between the mind and the hands must be the heart. That's actually true scientifically.
Okay.
I feel like that's one of the biggest points in the film, actually, because you have a mission, and if the mission is just left to the brain alone, it's kind of doomed to fail. But if your mission is different, like Hal has his own mission that you go into at the end of the article. I have my own interpretation of that somewhat inevitably, sure. But do you think we could go into that a little bit?
Yeah, please, can we just do that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's directed at you, Matt. I mean, because the filming at the end, the way that you take it.
Okay, as far as the crew, like the crew members being a film crew?
Yeah, like a little walkthrough of what your thesis is.
Okay. Well, to fit it in, okay, so maybe it starts with the conversation with Haywood Floyd and his two helpers, and when they're eating sandwiches on board that shuttle to go out to see the monolith on the moon. I think it's pretty clear, and this is really a non-traditional non-service level interpretation, is that their conversation about finding the monolith and you know, this is the first time that seemingly that Haywood Floyd has seen some of these photos of the monolith. What they're actually this is not like them, the two other guys showing Haywood Floyd their discovery. What they're doing is rehearsing this their story, this made up story of how the monolith was found. Let's see. So I'm trying to. Okay, here we go. False flag. Okay, so this is a quote. This is a quoting the movie here. So part of that conversation, Haywood says, "Oh, by the way, I want to say to both of you, I think you've done a wonderful job. I appreciate the way you've handled this thing." Ralph responds, "Well, the way we look at it, it's our job to do this thing the way you want it done. We're only too happy to be able to oblige." Okay. By the way, is that truck outside too loud?
I don't know.
I can close the window. You know, okay. So, you know, are they talking, does this sound like they're talking about like a major scientific discovery, or, you know, is something else going on? And then, you know, the scene concludes with Haywood saying, "Well, I must say, you guys have certainly come up with something." And then they all laugh.
Totally.
Right. I have to tell you, I love this interpretation. I think that's really valid. Really, really valid.
Okay.
Because that's like still the cover story. You're like watching the cover story still. It's like a cover on a cover, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so you get this feedback loop, which then manifests into a audio feedback loop, right? Which I know I've heard you guys talk about, and I just want to interject. It was very satisfying hearing you guys talk about the film. I mean, some of the things, like especially like David, when you were talking about the Renaissance room at the end and the jumping wine glass. I mean, you described this thing much better than what was written here, even. So I appreciate what you guys have just to be able to be understood. It was very satisfying. So. The way that that story extends, so that this is all a ruse. This is all just, you know, when they go down and actually photograph themselves by the monolith. Again, you have the same probably the same photographer, right? Act, you know, playing as part of the leopard of constructing this story, because he, you know, controlling the the population through information and media, in the same way that the leopard at the beginning controlled people through, you know, physical might, that this continues on with the, you know, putting together this film at the end of the monolith floating around the moons of Jupiter. And so, you know, I have to admit that the, I would say it's not as ironclad argument, but I would say suggestive, at least. And I'm interested to hear what an alternative perspective on this, David. But just to finish with this, the okay, one thing is that the if you look, there's like seven scenes where you see the monolith floating around, and it never moves in front of any body, any heavenly body, like a moon or a planet or the sun, which suggests that it's kind of maybe one way to easily transpose it onto the film. But perhaps actually more importantly, there's always a false reflection. Like you see, if you look at, there's always a glare on the monolith, but it's like opposite of where the sun is.
Oh
like
it's God, worse. I didn't even notice that. I'm sorry, I have to say it. So, you know, I actually am one of the people that believes that Pink Floyd had purposely done Pink Floyd Echoes to go in sync with Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite.
Oh.
And right, you know, as they go beyond, there's a line that it's no one flies around the sun.
Hmm.
Meaning that they're not actually going beyond the sun. There's this whole thing, like, if you want to send someone out, if you're going to go to those deep reaches of space, you'd literally have to fly around the sun, do a loop-de-loop in order to keep going. I mean, I remember that from school when they described what would be required. And so the fact that what you're saying in terms of the reflection of the sun is suggestive that they're not actually there. It's like Capricorn 1.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Let's see, and then some other part, like, so when part of that film is when the Discovery, you know, one of the pod bay doors opens and then you see the shuttle come out. Well, that shuttle was actually lost when Dave went to rescue Frank's body. And so, you know, that's something that is, that's something that is artificial. But then we get into the Renaissance room, and which is the white room, where David, you know, has one of the scenes where he's aged and has wrinkles on his face, but still within his spacesuit, it looks like his eyes are kind of wide open. And there's also the faint, you get that feedback sound again, actually. And so you have this high-pitched sound, which again is suggestive of a movie within a movie. And if you look to the right of the picture, it would be to Dave's left, but our right. Okay, so people are yelling outside. That there's two people dressed in dark clothes. And if you're looking at the, it's figure 54, section 3.8.2. that picture there where you could see two people on the right, and you see the pink heads and the kind of the hand, and in the movie one of them moves their arm, either it moves up to down or vice versa, and so I would say that the shock that he has in his face is that he has just realized that the crew has woken up and it's a movie crew,
mm-hmm.
and that he's actually in a movie. You know, even on this particular level, not in Kubrick's movie, but in the movie of this, you know, of the monolith propaganda movie. So that's kind of the main metaphrans, metaphors, and then this also fits in to the whole, you know, paradigm of, again, just the movie within a movie, which is somewhat, I guess, supportive of this notion, but I think that's some of the main stuff.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Oh boy.
David, you want to take that?
Oh boy, I don't know. I'm sitting here and I'm staring at David Bowman's eyes in that shot.
Right.
I'm feeling very similarly. No, I felt like, you know, that, like, upon reading this, like I was saying, I was expecting to come across the Millennium Hilton at the bottom here, and that we're watching this thing, we're observing this thing on 9/11, you know, and, like, it's our own, like, it's a projection of us relating to the thing. We're all watching this on a screen, unless if you're there, you know, and even if you're there, you're stuck with your own trying to piece this thing. It's just it's amazing how, like, with this film, you know, it got such terrible critical response, you know, like this wasn't a successful film in that sense, you know, and yet here we are, you know, post 2001, we're still finding these things. Like, I feel like what you're presenting here is totally a legitimate interpretation, and it's incredible that it took this long for, I mean, I watched this film how many times in the theater even, and have, like, completely didn't even catch the hoses being flipped. It's like, you know, it actually took this long to figure it out. Similarly, like with, like, 9/11 or JFK or something, it's like, you, things are still coming to the surface. I mean, I just watched a JFK documentary recently. I thought I knew most of the things there was to know about it with all I've looked at, you know, and, like, boom, these are big pieces, you know. I mean, this is a big piece. And so that self-reflection of that you're within a movie, within a movie, within a movie, actually, if you want to really go there with it, you can see that there's a feedback loop happening.
You made me realize when you said that we're all watching on a screen unless you're actually there, you know, even looking at, so of course we're looking at footage, but if you were there and you could see this in the witnesses on the ground, everyone's like craning their necks to look up at, you know, what's happening at the top of this building. It almost reminds me of if you've ever had to sit in the front row of a movie theater. The way it's so uncomfortable to stretch your neck back and have to look up at the thing, you don't actually get a good view of it. So it's almost like if you're really there, you're stretching your neck up trying to see the damn thing, and the only way to step back, you end up like the rest of us watching it on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your point about the JFK stuff is so poignant, because that's how I feel. It's like all these things, you know, you can get to a point where you think you've researched something enough, there's always a new way to look at it. And just as Matt said at the beginning, every few years you change, and you might have had an experience that lets you contextualize it differently or,
yeah,
you know, or something like that. So there's the more, I want to say, like, scientific work of, say, Matt scrutinizing the details of, oh, is it flipped, is it not, is, you know, is what side hose is that on? I think John Fell Ryan is another person who really goes through and looks for these small details that, in this respect, it's like if you're looking at a JFK conspiracy, finding out, oh, did someone find a bullet shell, or did someone, you know, whatever it is, like finding out the actual little details. And then when you try and put the big picture together, it really depends on your perspective, conceptualization, the time of your life you're in, where your head is at. You know, you kept talking before about the mathematical sets, and then we have a movie set, the idea of the set of all sets, you know, is that not the material matrix? And I couldn't help but think of, you know, Timothy Leary's idea of a psychedelic experience, which to me, every experience is, in a sense, a psychedelic experience. It's your mind trying to perceive the moment according to your brain, you know, your unique take on it. And then that he referred to this as set and setting were the two major components of any psychedelic experience. So it's, you know, the set being what you bring into it, your almost like a mathematical set, what do you bring into it with you, and then the setting is what is the external environment around you. In this case, you have the idea of a movie set, you know, like, it did Kubrick fake the moon landing? Well, you know, here we have Dave Bowman finding himself on a set, thinking he's in space, but actually finding he's on a set, you know, all this sort of stuff. We keep coming back to the same words, and I guess and I'm not trying to muddy any waters here, but just to say what I kind of come back to is this idea of I do find it hard at some point to parse where the intentionality stops and where we end up with layer upon layer upon layer of metaphor. Is it because it's all speaking to the same thing, or is it because it's an intentionality? And I think that's why I asked you, Matt, at the beginning, like or earlier, if you felt, if there was ever a point in which you thought perhaps Kubrick was involved or aware. And obviously this is framed in the sense of a false flag, that there are legitimate false flags. There are legitimate corruption and propaganda and all these things. And I don't want to in any way deny that. So I guess I'm asking, where do you personally see these things resting? Is it a this and that, or this or that? Where do you sort of see these things overlapping?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's certainly not mutually exclusive. I mean, it's a multi-dimensional reality. I think, you know, anytime we do something or anytime something happens, is it, you know, how often is it just for one reason versus most of the time it's, you know, it's a combination of reasons. Just, you know, things are most of the time a synthesis. So it's just, you know, not getting into this this mindset of mutual exclusion.
Well said. Absolutely.
I mean, how is this for irony? You know, like, I actually feel more like religious about this film than I think I do just about any other film. and you know, like, I feel religious about Pink Floyd, seriously. And I you know, I look at this and I'm like, well, you know, this, like, Defy Hollywood. It's like the implication there, just in the way that that's presented. It's like literally that it's like a religion. And I feel like that's what's happening for them. Like, and I don't think that that's that far-fetched. And that obviously if anybody would be hip to that, it would be Stanley Kubrick, you know. Even, you know, where he has his producer in Eyes Wide Shut is like the man at the throne, and, you know, with the Masonic chair, you know. It's like, what's that?
Yeah, Red Cloak.
Yeah, the Red Cloak. I forget what his name is, Vitali, or I can't remember. But
yeah, just, like Tony Vitali.
But just like, well, if anything's being communicated, you know, it's like, it's a very religious thing. I mean, I love, there's a John Lennon quote where he says, 2001 A Space Odyssey should be played in a cathedral every day. You know, it's like, apparently the Pope stood up and watched 2001 and like gave an ovation at the end, like put his hands up and was just like, and is quoted as of saying, that is the closest thing to the Gnostic experience I've ever seen represented as an art form. And like, you know, and meanwhile you have this false flag interpretation, which is also like completely valid. And like, I don't know, I really wonder about that. Like, people have attacked you know, the idea of synchromysticism, saying that the synchronicities that are showing up, like, we have a friend with a blog called The Subliminal Synchrosphere, and he's very like adamant about communicating that he believes this is, you know, what we're looking at as meaningful coincidences that are possibly intentional. He insists that they're very intentional and that it's a mind control, you know, conspiracy, which I don't rule out, you know. But I also feel like there's something to be said, and I find this with certain people more than others, where, including myself, where if you're just so open and you're willing to consider all possibilities and yet take them with a grain of salt, and just remain open, that there are things that end up coming up that you just can't quite reconcile and that really stick. You know, they're like they become like nodes. And I feel like you've pointed out a few of those, just like, because you can see there's no possibility of unintentionality in flipping the frames. Now, what you want to extrapolate from that is a different story, yet your extrapolations feel totally like real possibilities. But those points that you found from being open to consider, to not just accepting something at face value, are what led to those discoveries in the first place, which then, to the reader, they're open to look at them how they will, but they're still there. They're like, they're points of.
If your mirror has a monster in it, do not shout. This kind of situation does not call for freaking out. And do nothing that you would not like to see him do. Cause that monster in the mirror, he just might be you. Singing wabba 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 woo woo.